Does antibiotic treatment have anything to do with the development of obesity in children?
Which bariatric procedure is most effective for weight loss?
If you have mild high blood pressure, should you have treatment?
And of all the medications available, are some better than others at preventing stroke in people with atrial fibrillation?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on November 2nd, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to start first with JAMA Internal Medicine, because I think this is a study that really is going to impact a huge number of people. This is an analysis of what happens if we treat mild hypertension. I was kind of amazed at the results, especially in view of the guidelines that are out there now saying, hey, we want to treat this population of people. This was a really huge study, and it went on for a long time. They extracted data from January 1, 1998 through September 30, 2015 for patients between the ages of 18 and 74 years, that's pretty impressive, with untreated blood pressure of 140 over 90 to 159 over 99. So that's definitely in that cohort where treatment is now recommended. They excluded anyone with a history of cardiovascular disease or risk factors, and they took a look at long-term outcomes in these folks. They were able to match a total of 19,143 treated patients versus the same number who were untreated. They found that treatment was associated with an increased risk of adverse events, including blood pressure that was too low, hypotension, syncope, fainting, electrolyte abnormalities, and acute kidney injury. And so the upshot of this study was, hey, there's a number of really adverse outcomes that can happen if we treat these people to target. Flies in the face of these other recommendations that we've been talking about now in the last year.
It goes counter to what we've previously talked about. So what's different about this study? Well, the main thing is these were individuals that had two things. They had mild hypertension, but more importantly, they were considered to be low-risk patients. And most of the other studies that have identified that this group benefits from lowering their blood pressure were not low-risk patients. Low-risk patients were those that did not have any history of heart disease, thickening of their heart muscle called left ventricular hypertrophy. They didn't have atrial fibrillation or diabetes. And you're right, treating their mild hypertension did not improve their overall outcome over the course of 6 years. It didn't lower their cardiovascular risk. It was associated with complications. So that's the key.
Does that suggest to you then that the guidelines that now all of these societies have endorsed relative to when we need to initiate treatment in people's blood pressure should be modified so that they say if you have other risk factors, that's when we're going to initiate treatment?
I think this study alone probably shouldn't be the foundation for that. This was not a randomized controlled prospective trial. This is called a longitudinal cohort study. And so I think we need to have other studies specifically that look at low-risk patients. I think we need to examine this more carefully before we make that blanket recommendation.
I would just say in my personal opinion for right now, if I were a person without any other risk factors and my physician said, look, based on your 145 over 100, I want you to start being treated, I might push back on that.
That's true, Elizabeth. But if it was closer to 158 or 159 over 100, you might feel differently. So there is a little bit of a continuum. So stay tuned as we learn more about this particular topic.
Okay, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine, this ongoing issue of bariatric surgery in the face of so much obesity, both domestically and worldwide. Let's look at outcomes relative to different types.
This is important because at one time we just had one type of surgery, that is gastric bypass. But now there are at least two other procedures, one called an adjustable gastric banding and the other called a sleeve gastrectomy. And as a result, there are fewer people undergoing gastric bypass and more having these other procedures. What this study attempted to address was, well, of those three procedures, let's do a comparative effectiveness and safety study. And this is a part of what's called the PCORI, or the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. And so in this particular study, they looked at over 65,000 patients at 41 health systems that were participating in this National Patient-Centered Clinical Research Network. About 30,000 of these had gastric bypass surgery, about 30,000 had the sleeve gastrectomy, and about 3,000 had gastric banding. And what they found out was the gastric bypass, 5% of those individuals had a serious complication, with the other procedures about 2.5 to 3%. But when they looked at 1 year and 5 years down the road, the individuals that had the highest weight loss were those that received gastric bypass surgery compared to the other two. So the value of this study is it's large, it's community-based, and it compares the outcomes of different therapies that are available to suggest which might be most effective.
So two questions occur to me. One of them, of course, is relative to the metabolic complications that sometimes people who have gastric bypass experience. The second one is one profound benefit, of course, of these procedures is that people have resolution of type 2 diabetes often, and that occurs even with modest weight loss. So I guess I'm questioning, sure, there's the cosmetic aspect of it and the weight loss aspect of it, but if what we're really trying to do is avoid type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular complications, is it adequate to just lose a modest amount of weight?
Those are great questions. And this study didn't look at the sequela with each of these operations, so it's hard to address that. But you're right, there are more complications associated with gastric bypass. And this type of information is helpful for the healthcare provider and the patient to look at all the options to weigh which is best for that particular patient.
Exactly. Let's move now to, speaking of obesity and its treatment, in the British Medical Journal, the journal Gut, a look at antibiotic use in childhood and acid suppression medications in early childhood and their association with obesity. This is, again, one of those big old cohort studies that looks retrospectively at a bunch of data that's been gathered, of course. And this one took place from October 2006 to September 2013. They looked at children who had any dispensed prescription for an antibiotic, an H2 blocker, PPI medication in the first 2 years of life. They had 333,000 plus children who met this inclusion criteria. Now what happens when we take a look at them over the long haul? The upshot, again, of this whole thing was that antibiotics, acid suppressants, and the combination in the first 2 years of life are associated with a diagnosis of childhood obesity. Their hypothesis is that the microbiota, especially the gut microbiota, is altered when these things are used, and they think that that early alteration may influence weight gain in later childhood.
I found this pretty fascinating, and it centers around a couple other things that we know. For example, if you want to fatten cattle, you do that by giving them antibiotics. And by the way, if you start the antibiotics earlier in life, they're more likely to gain more weight, suggesting that changing the gut microbiota actually influences obesity. Furthermore, we know that children who are born by C-section as opposed to vaginal delivery also have a higher incidence of obesity because it's thought that that passage through the birth canal actually changes the gut microbiota and makes obesity less common. I thought this was a fascinating study because both antibiotics and acid suppression changed gut microbiota and was associated, by the way, in this particular study with a 25 to 40% increased risk of obesity in kids. The longer you took them or the more of these that you took, the increased risk of obesity. So I thought this was a fascinating study.
I'm surprised you're not disparaging it because it's an association and not a causality.
That's true. And so all of these are circumstantial evidence, but they all point towards the same thing. And by the way, we know that that happens also in adults. If you change the microbiota or do a gut transplant from somebody that's obese to somebody that is not.
I think it's really interesting that the H2 blockers and the PPI inhibitors could result in obesity. And I could understand a strategy whereby we could reduce the use of those medications in childhood. I'm wondering, however, about the use of antibiotics. I suspect in this population, it's largely middle ear infections or maybe URIs. And so I'm wondering how we're going to reduce antibiotic use if this is, in fact, a proven association.
So, Elizabeth, first of all, we would never recommend that parents not receive the prescribed therapy that is indicated, especially for fighting infections. However, we've talked before, at least a third of the antibiotic prescriptions that are passed out are without indication. If we can eliminate a third of the antibiotic use because it's not indicated, we could potentially lower the risk of childhood obesity as well at the same time.
Okay, let's turn back to yours in Annals. Again, taking a look at a population that's really big that could be impacted by this, non-traditional oral anticoagulants and atrial fibrillation.
This is important because atrial fibrillation is really the most common cardiac arrhythmia in the United States. And it's estimated over the next couple decades, there'll be 12 million Americans that suffer with this. Those individuals are likely to have a clot form in the atrium, in a little particular part of it called the atrial appendage. And when that happens, that clot can dislodge and cause a stroke. Coumadin's been the time-honored treatment to prevent that. And it's about 65 to 80% effective in preventing strokes. But we now have newer agents. And these are all direct acting. Coumadin is indirect acting. So they call these DOACs, direct acting oral anticoagulants. And they've been approved for stroke prevention. Are they as effective as Coumadin? Because all anticoagulants have a risk of bleeding. Is the risk higher or lower than Coumadin? So of the four that are available, one of those is called a thrombin inhibitor, dabigatran. And the other three are all factor 10A inhibitors. I call them the bands, apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban. Compared to Coumadin, dabigatran and apixaban are superior to preventing stroke, and the other two are very similar. With regard to bleeding, apixaban and edoxaban are superior to warfarin in reducing the risk of bleeding. The other are very similar. And then finally, when you look at all different subgroups, are there any in which Coumadin is better than these DOACs? The answer is no.
We know, of course, that warfarin or Coumadin has a high, I'm going to call it a pain in the neck value. Somebody has to go and get it measured. Is this working? Am I at the right place? And gosh, if you end up in a place where you need to have surgery, it's a little troublesome. What would you regard as the downsides of the DOACs? They're significantly more expensive. That's one I can think of.
So you mentioned Coumadin. First of all, you have to have your blood check. And secondly, there's a lot of interaction with other drugs and with different foods. Now, that's not true with the DOACs. They are more costly. And so if you're not on an insurance plan that covers them, they can be prohibitively costly and people can't afford them. The second is not all of them can be reversed. With Coumadin, if someone's blood is too thin or they're bleeding, you can reverse the effects with vitamin K. With the DOACs, not all of them yet. But having said that, when you look at the bleeding risk with the DOACs, with two of the agents, they have a lower bleeding risk than Coumadin, and with the others, it's very similar.
On that note, I'd like to tell all of our listeners that if you're looking for the hyperlinks for the literature citations, look on our program notes on our homepage. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.